From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Welcome to the Tuesday edition of Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here at FRC Action, filling for Tony Perkins. Well, I'll kick off the show today with a story of a female student athlete named Selena Soul in Connecticut who lost a scholarship because of competition with biological boys presenting themselves as female. She appeared last night on Tucker Carlson's Fox News show, and I'll be talking with Alliance Defending Freedom attorney Denise Harrell about whether this is the beginning of the end for women's sports. In my second segment, the Kleins are back in the news. Yesterday, the Supreme Court remanded the case of the Sweet Cakes by Melissa Bakery back to the Oregon Appellate Court, which had fined the Christian bakers $135,000 for refusing to bake a cake for a lesbian wedding. I'll talk with Kelly Shackelford, President and Chief Counsel of First Liberty, about what the decision means. At the bottom of the hour, a proposed California law bans professional counselors from helping young patients deal with unwanted homosexual attraction or gender identity issues. Peter Sprigg, FRC's Senior Fellow for Policy Studies, will join me to talk about his comments before the California Assembly. And in my last segment, we'll talk about anti-hate and anti-bullying programs in school. Are they always what they appear to be? Teachers' unions are pushing a platform to report hate incidents that links directly to the discredited Southern Poverty Law Center. Rebecca Friedrichs, author of Standing Up to Goliath, Battling State and National Teachers' Unions for the Heart and Soul of Our Kids, will join me to discuss. Before I get to my first story today, here's a quick reminder. We know the radical left is showing their true colors through advocating for special LGBT rights that will erode religious liberty, to pushing for abortion on demand up until the day of birth. It has become clear our freedoms are at stake. Innocent lives are on the line, and we will not stop fighting to uphold our religious liberties and save unborn children, but we need your help. Our fiscal year here at FRC ends on June 30th, and we must finish this year strong to sustain the momentum for pro-faith and pro-family policies in Washington. We're asking our listeners to help us match $25,000 in challenge funds, doubling your gift dollar for dollar. With so much on the line for faith, family, and freedom, let me encourage you to call our phone bank, 1-800-225-4008. To help us at FRC remain standing strong as your voice. That's 1-800-225-4008. Well, you've probably heard her name in the news before. High school track star Selena Soul missed her opportunity to compete in the New England Regionals after finishing behind two biological boys presenting themselves as women. Now Soul is speaking out and is using the legal system to try to regain her Title IX rights. In an interview with the Daily Signal on May 6th, Connecticut track and field athlete Selena explained how she was defeated by two young men. It killed her opportunity to qualify, but more than that, it affected how she felt even competing from the outset. Let's listen in.
When I'm lining up and getting into my blocks, everyone already knows the outcome. Those two athletes are going to come. 1 and 2, and everyone knows it. From third on, it's a little different. We're actually fighting for those spots, but in those meets, there's no way that one of us biological girls will be able to outrun those transgender athletes. And eventually, it's going to get to the point where the biological females will be on the sidelines watching their own sports.
Joining me now is Denise Harrell, the Alliance Defending Freedom attorney who is working with Selena Soul on a new legal case. Denise, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thanks so much for having me.
Selena and you both appeared on Tucker Carlson's show last night on Fox, but I'd like to explain how ADF is filing a Title IX complaint on behalf of Selena and other athletes who are suffering from similar circumstances, because this is really sort of the crack in the wall, isn't it? This is the first and probably most publicized situation in which a student, a female student, has found herself incapable of advocating until she makes a legal claim that her rights guaranteed to her under Title IX have actually been infringed. So can you explain a little bit about the complaint that ADF has filed?
Absolutely. Girls deserve to compete on a level playing field, and that's what Title IX was designed to do. It was designed to eliminate discrimination against women and young women in education and athletics, and to create equal opportunities for women. So allowing boys to compete against girls in girls' sports reverses nearly 50 years of advances that women have made under Title IX. So what we've done is, on behalf of Selena and a couple other female athletes, we filed a Title IX complaint with the Office of Civil Rights in the Department of Education. And that will initiate an investigation into what's going on in Connecticut and hopefully have the policy reversed.
So in your new press release on the Title IX complaint, you point out that ever since the Connecticut Interscholastic Athletic Conference, so the CIAC, adopted this policy allowing for transgender females, and I'm using air quotes because these are truly biological males, allowing them to compete in girls-only sports, boys have consistently deprived Selena and other female athletes of honors and opportunities to compete at elite levels. So has Selena lost out on scholarship opportunities because of this circumstance?
Absolutely. If you think about it this way, for every boy on the podium, that means one less girl on the podium. And it's more than just medals. You know, these female athletes have trained for years and years and years to be able to demonstrate their craft and their practice and to be able to be seen by college recruiters and potentially get a college scholarship or go on to a career in coaching. And there's no way to know what opportunities are being lost because these girls are forcibly removed from the ability to win.
And this is a circumstance in which there were two spots preventing Selena from going to the championships and potentially competing for a college scholarship. Not surprisingly, those are the exact two spots that were taken by the two transgender athletes running in the same event, the 55 meter in the New England Regional. So there's an obvious cause and effect here. Does she have an opportunity in the future at this school, in this athletic conference, to compete only against biological females going forward, or has the tie permanently shifted?
Well, that's what we're hoping our Title IX complaint will secure for Selena and other female athletes, is to, you know, finally have these policies looked at, these policies that have been enacted by local school boards or interscholastic athletic groups without any sort of legal analysis or challenge. It's just sort of allowed. So we're asking the federal government to step in, investigate it, and make clear that this is a violation of Title IX. And if that happens, then that will send a message to all jurisdictions around the state that they have to allow their girls to have a level playing field. Because, as an example in Connecticut shows, there's one boy who now holds over 10 state records that once belonged to more than to 10 different girls. And those records were made over the course of 20 years, and they've now just been completely obliterated in 1 year by one boy.
We understand that there are widespread, pervasive, well-documented biological differences between men and women, unless anyone try to convince the listeners to this program otherwise. A simple Google search will indicate otherwise. Everything from muscle mass to bone density to height to muscular distribution and overall strength, they are competing with an obvious biological advantage. Here's what struck me when I read the interview with Selena Soul in the Daily Signal. She really talked about the fact that this was something she had been initially afraid to talk about and was automatically at a disadvantage ideologically because she said the narrative now, as you and I know so well, is that if you criticize the transgender movement, you are automatically transphobic. Not that you want an equal playing field, not that you feel as if it's a minimization of female rights, not that you are concerned that biological men are creating new categories for record breaking and eliminating female opportunities. Simply that she didn't feel comfortable opening her mouth. She was scared about this having an impact on college down the road. Even that, she says, could be impacted. So this really has very long-lasting and widespread implications. There is another student. I would like to know about a mid-level male sophomore athlete. He failed to advance in boys' indoor track during the winter 2018 season. So what did this athlete do next?
Well, he's one of the athletes who now is identifying as a girl and is competing against girls and, frankly, dominating them. And, you know, Selena was right to be afraid because she's experienced quite a bit of retaliation from her coaches and the administration at her school. And all she's asking for is a fair shake. All she's asking for is what women have fought for a long time, and that is to have equal opportunities and to be recognized that we have unique characteristics.
These are girls who have, as you've said, trained for years to build up these individual records. They have trained for countless hours, and we're talking the difference, as you know, in track and field of simply seconds or portions of seconds. And just like that, with the inclusion of transgender athletes, the entire playing field has been changed. In fact, there are, lest anyone think that this is an outlier in Connecticut, there are 17 states that allow participation of transgender biological men, transgender females, air quotes, with biological females across the country. So this is really something. Until an organization like ADF gets involved, was promising to get worse, not better. So we here at FRC thank you for the efforts on behalf of Selena Sewell. We will be following this very carefully and appreciate all of your work, your good work at ADF, and particularly on this issue and on behalf of athletes like Selena Sewell. With those who are listening online, I encourage you to go to frc.org/events. Tomorrow here at FRC, we will have a lecture by Dr. Jennifer Bryson called Religious Freedom in Sports. Two rather unlikely bedfellows previously, but now a frequent topic of discussion in the media and in politics. Tomorrow at noon Eastern, that's Wednesday the 19th at noon Eastern, you can stream it live online. Go to frc.org/events. Jennifer Bryson is the founder of Let All Play, which is a coalition dedicated to the removal of politics in international sports. She has also written extensively on religious liberty as concerns sports, and her recent report in 2019 was Let All Play, Yes to Soccer, No to Politics. So I encourage you to join tomorrow, frc.org/events. Well, we've had a chance to talk to ADF about the issue of biological males competing with females. Coming up next, we'll talk about wedding cakes yet again. The Supreme Court remanded Melissa Klein's bakery case back to Oregon yesterday, which had fined Christian bakers $135,000 for refusing to bake a cake for a lesbian wedding. Kelly Shackelford of First Liberty will join me to discuss what it means.
Today, military personnel are at greater risk than ever of suffering from a mental health condition. On average, 21 active and retired military members take their own lives every day. Richard Gleaston, a military and veteran advocate in the area of mental health, recently shared evidence that faith-based solutions can help stop this crisis Here's what Richard had to say.
There's new science out that they watch people while they're praying or have a religious relationship. The frontal part of their brain, if I'm correct in remembering what they told me, it strengthens it. It reduces depression, reduces anxiety and stress while you're doing it. So not only did God give us prayer as a way to alleviate our spirit, it also alleviates our mind and our bodies. Our bodies react in a positive way to a faith-based relationship.
Visit frc.org/speakers to hear more.
If you're like me, you care about the future of our country. Now more than ever, it is vital that we stand up for biblical values. This year, you can. Come to the annual Values Voter Summit in Washington, D.C. on October 11th through the 13th and join thousands of Americans like you who want to change the culture so that human life is valued, families flourish, and religious liberty thrives. This year, we're calling on Americans to pray, to vote, and to stand firm as we fight back to win the culture. Invited and confirmed speakers include Dana Lesh, Sebastian Gorka, Bill Bennett, Laura Ingraham, and Reverend Franklin Graham. Now is the time to stand for truth. There will be opportunities to meet with organizations and attendees that share a biblical worldview on issues like religious liberty, the LGBT movement, the sanctity of life, the realities of socialism, and more. Visit valuesvotersummit.org for more information. That's valuesvotersummit.org.
Did you know that babies survive failed abortions? Sadly, many of these babies are denied their human right to life and are allowed to die. Currently, there is no federal criminal statute in place to protect these babies after they are born alive. Congress and state legislatures across the country have responded by putting forth legislation to protect infants who survive abortion. However, leftist politicians have blocked efforts in Congress and in state legislatures to pass the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act, which requires that life-saving medical care be given to babies born alive after failed abortion attempts. We must decide as a country where we stand on the issue of infanticide, to either pursue humane protections for those most vulnerable in our society, or continue to subject innocent human life to the whims of abortionists. For more information, visit frc.org/bornalive.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here, filling in for Tony Perkins this Tuesday. The U.S. Supreme Court has vacated an adverse ruling against an Oregon couple, fining them $135,000 for declining to create a cake for a lesbian wedding. This is Christian Baker couple, Melissa and Aaron Klein of Sweet Cakes by Melissa. You remember them. They have been in the news since 2013, and they have been fighting this quite a long time. It was a long road to the Supreme Court, and today the Supreme Court had issued their vacation of judgment. Let's listen in to what they had to say at FRC's Value Voter Summit all the way back in 2014.
Sometimes it would take 2 hours of sitting in a cake tasting. And if they chose me to do their cake, I'm sorry. Sure. I would just feel so honored to be able to be a part of such an amazing, special day.
The Supreme Court's order of yesterday indicated, quote, the petition for a writ of certiorari is granted, the judgment is vacated, and the case is remanded to the Court of Appeals of Oregon for further consideration in light of Masterpiece Cake Shop versus Colorado Civil Rights Commission. Well, for those of you who are not lawyers, that is a lot of legal gobbledygook. And I'm excited to talk to my next guest, Kelly Shackelford, the president and chief counsel of First Liberty. Kelly, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Yo, thanks for having me on.
Well, I'm reminded immediately of the June 2018 Supreme Court ruling when it asked the Washington Supreme Court to revisit the ruling in the Arlene's Flowers case. Can you talk to me a little bit about the obvious parallels here?
Yeah, it's very similar. In fact, the incredible similarity is, I mean, Aaron and Melissa Klein, their facts are incredibly close to the Jack Phillips facts. they had a couple that came in that they served, had no problem serving. And then they asked them to do a custom wedding cake for their same-sex wedding. And they said they couldn't do that. And they gave them a referral because of their faith. But they gave them a referral to another place. And the next thing they knew, the state of Oregon was coming after them. They were fined $135,000. Their business was bankrupted. And then all the things that would follow after that, the death threats to them and their children and everything else. And so it's really similar in certain ways to Jack Phillips' case. And in fact, the hostility from the judge, the commissioner, before they had ever had a hearing, he stated publicly that they needed to be, quote, rehabilitated. Mm. That's not exactly a neutral tribunal. And
I was just going to say.
So I think there's a lot of similarities to what happened to Jack and what happened to them. And while, you know, we wish today, the Supreme Court would have just taken the Sweet Cakes case, the Klein's case here, and resolved the big issue for everybody. They sent it back down and we're really grateful because they did vacate the bad decision below, send it back down and say, look, you haven't evaluated this case under Masterpiece about, you know, just religious hostility. You need to do that as well before you come back up here to the Supreme Court.
So your hope, I am assuming, is the same as it is mine, which is understanding what the judgment was in Masterpiece Cake Shop, that this ought to, upon remand, be a win for the Kleins. Do you anticipate that the Oregon Appellate Court will determine that particular win for religious liberty?
Well, you would hope so. Oregon is one of the more liberal states in the country. They've been certainly not friendly to religious freedom. And so we will hope that they will look at the facts and look at the Supreme Court opinion and realize, wow, we've got to rule in favor of the Kleins and Sweet Cakes. But if they don't, we'll go right back up to the Supreme Court, and I think we'll be set up very well for them to really put an end to this. And it's not just happening to Melissa, as you mentioned. It's not just happening to Jack Phillips. It's happened to Arlene, and Arlene's Flowers. It's happened to photographers. It's happened to people, even doing invitation cards. And really the principle is something that applies to everybody of faith who has a business, which is the principle is, can the government bankrupt your business, shut you down if they don't like your religious beliefs, if you don't share whatever beliefs the government has about particular controversial issues? And that's something that I feel strongly that the court is eventually going to take and make clear, that we do not allow the government to have that kind of power in this country. And unfortunately, until we get there, we're going to continue to have people that are, persecuted the way these families have been persecuted, which is really unfortunate.
And I do want to reiterate for our listeners that Aaron and Melissa Klein had served the two women, Rachel Cryer and Laurel Bowman, in other ways. And the women returned because the couple expressly had treated them kindly in a loving manner. They just drew the line at 1 Timothy 5:22, which commands us to not be partakers in other men's sin. And so they said, listen, it's simply this particular event. We love you. Come in. Continue to utilize our services. So hopefully what we'll see, if the court decides fairly and utilizing Masterpiece Cake Shop as its legal yardstick in this case, it will be determined the right way. But this is a couple who was fined $135,000, and they eventually dropped off a check. Where did that money come from?
Yeah, well, people came forward to support them because they knew they had no job. Their business was destroyed. And so actually at the very beginning, they had a GoFundMe account open. But within hours, there was like $70,000 or so dollars already in it, people rushing to their support. And the LGBT leaders complained to GoFundMe, and so GoFundMe shut their account down. Mm. And so the Franklin Graham fortunately opened, an ability for people to make donations, and they were able to get the penalty paid.
Well, we will be following closely. Kelly Shackelford, President and Chief Counsel of First Liberty, has been my guest today. You are listening to Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry. Director of Partnerships here sitting in for Tony Perkins. Coming up next, a proposed California law bans professional counselors from helping young people deal with gender identity confusion and unwanted homosexual attraction. Peter Sprigg, our Senior Fellow of Policy Studies, will join me to discuss the resolution next.
Did you know that babies survive failed abortions? Sadly, many of these babies are denied their human right to life and are allowed to die. Currently, there is no federal criminal statute in place to protect these babies after they are born alive. Congress and state legislatures across the country have responded by putting forth legislation to protect infants who survive abortion. However, leftist politicians have blocked efforts in Congress and in state legislatures to pass the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act, which requires that life-saving medical care be given to babies born alive after failed abortion attempts. We must decide as a country where we stand on the issue of infanticide, to either pursue humane protections for those most vulnerable in our society, or continue to subject innocent human life to the whims of abortionists. For more information, visit frc.org/bornalive. Today, military personnel are at greater risk than ever of suffering from a mental health condition. On average, 21 active and retired military members take their own lives every day. Richard Gleaston, a military and veteran advocate in the area of mental health, recently shared evidence that faith-based solutions can help stop this crisis. Here's what Richard had to say.
There's new science out that they watch people while they're praying or have a religious relationship. The frontal part of their brain, if I'm correct in remembering what they told me, it strengthens it. It reduces depression, reduces anxiety and stress while you're doing it. So not only did God give us prayer as a way to alleviate our spirit, it also alleviates our mind and our bodies. Our bodies react in a positive way to a faith-based relationship.
Visit frc.org/speakers to hear more.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships, sitting in for Tony Perkins. As a reminder, TonyPerkins.com is our podcast website. You can find more information on today's guests and the resources cited there. Follow Tony on Twitter at T Perkins, or me if you'd like at Sarah P. Perry. Well, Democratic Representative Evan Lowe, who is a self-proclaimed homosexual, has introduced an assembly concurrent resolution, ACR 99. And you've probably heard about these before. It's a conversion therapy ban. This particular resolution seeks to take away the freedom to give or receive assistance for those experiencing same-sex attraction or confusion about their gender identity. So that's a lot of gobbledygook to sort of unthread. Today, I'm going to talk to Peter Sprigg, our Senior Fellow for Policy Studies, who will help me understand a little bit about what the resolution is designed to do and the impact it might have. Peter, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thank you, Sarah.
Well, if this particular resolution becomes a law, what will it mean, practically speaking, for not only counselors, but let's say church or ministerial counselors, those who counsel within a pastoral context? Will it have the impact of totally silencing speech on the issue?
Well, let me go back and give a little bit more of the history, and I'll try to do this as succinctly as I can. But in 2012, California became the first state to pass legal restrictions on sexual orientation change efforts, what they call, what opponents call conversion therapy. And that was to prohibit such therapy when practiced on minors by a licensed mental health provider. So it applied only for therapy to minors and only for a licensed mental health provider with the with the sanction being the potential loss of license. Well, then last year, Assemblymember Evan Lowe introduced a much more sweeping ban that would have applied, would have had no age restriction, would have applied regardless of the age of the client or the and would have applied to any type of counselor, including a religious counselor, not just to licensed mental health providers, as long as they were paid a fee for their service. And what it did was to declare that it was consumer fraud to offer to change someone's sexual orientation or gender identity. There was a tremendous amount of pushback on that, and I give Mr. Lowe credit for actually listening, going up and down the state and listening to pastors, listening to a lot of the criticism, and he withdrew that bill, AB 2943, on the last day of the session at the end of August. Mm. Even though it was still expected to pass, he voluntarily withdrew the bill and said he wanted to seek some kind of greater consensus. Now, this resolution is apparently the result. And it because it's just a resolution, it's only expressing the sense of the legislature. It's not it would not impose any actual legal restriction on what people can practice. However, I will tell you, this is what I think the purpose of this is. It is a divide and conquer strategy with the church. Because there are, he was able to find some people in his listening sessions last year who are Christians who are critical of this type of therapy. In my opinion, these are people who don't really understand the therapy. They have internalized some of the criticisms from LGBT activists. They don't actually know people who have gone through this therapy or people who practice it. And so they are skeptical of the therapy, but they were very concerned about the potential threat to religious liberty because the bill last year was so sweeping. So his response here is to bring in this non-binding resolution, but I believe what he hopes to do is win the support of a significant number of Christian leaders and Christian institutions, colleges, pastors, and so forth, in this, which would be very damaging to the movement of people who believe that change is possible and that that it should be the right of a counselor or a therapist to help people seek that kind of change. And the heart of this resolution is the declaration that performing conversion therapy on young persons is ineffective, unethical, and harmful. And I simply believe that all three of those are false statements. Mm.
So you had a hand in taking the lead in drafting comments that were submitted to the California Assembly that was signed on to by a number of other partners who believe, as you do, as we do, that there are options for this particular counseling that have proven to be psychologically beneficial. If you had to offer one point from this comment, what is the most critical takeaway from the commentary submitted to the Assembly?
Well, there are several commentaries that were submitted. I signed onto a letter that was drafted by others, kind of a group letter, and also I drafted a shorter statement on behalf of Family Research Council itself, which was submitted to the committee. This was all came together very quickly because they were holding a hearing this morning, and floor action is expected potentially by Thursday of this week. But the key point that I made in the piece I drafted for FRC was that first of all, sexual orientation can change, and I've written a major paper for FRC published in March that demonstrates that, and it can change as a and there have been studies showing that the therapy can be effective and is not generally harmful to people who participate in it. And I wrote a paper on that that was published last year in September, I think. So we've done in-depth research here at FRC on that, both of those issues.
So much more to talk about. Peter Sprager, Senior Fellow for Policy Studies. Go to TonyPerkins.com for more information. You are listening to Washington Watch. Coming up next, the fox in the hen house of education and liberalism. Rebecca Friedrichs joins me next.
Today, military personnel are at greater risk than ever of suffering from a mental health condition. On average, 21 active and retired military members take their own lives every day.
Richard Gleaston, a military and veteran advocate in the area of mental health, recently shared evidence that faith-based solutions can help stop this crisis. Here's what Richard had to say.
There's new science out that they watch people while they're praying or have a religious relationship. The frontal part of their brain, if I'm correct in remembering what they told me, it strengthens it. It reduces depression, reduces anxiety and stress while you're doing it. So not only did God give us prayer as a way to alleviate our spirit, it also alleviates our mind and our bodies. Our bodies react in a positive way to a faith-based relationship.
Visit frc.org/speakers to hear more.
If you're like me, you care about the future of our country. Now more than ever, it is vital that we stand up for biblical values. This year, you can. Come to the annual Values Voter Summit in Washington, D.C. on October 11th through the 13th and join thousands of Americans like you who want to change the culture so that human life is valued, families flourish, and religious liberty thrives. This year, we're calling on Americans to pray, to vote, and to stand firm as we fight back to win the culture. Invited and confirmed speakers include Dana Lesh, Sebastian Gorka, Bill Bennett, Laura Ingraham, and Reverend Franklin Graham. Now is the time to stand for truth. There will be opportunities to meet with organizations and attendees that share a biblical worldview on issues like religious liberty, the LGBT movement, the sanctity of life, the realities of socialism, and more. Visit valuesvotersummit.org for more information. That's valuesvotersummit.org.
Did you know that babies survive failed abortions? Sadly, many of these babies are denied their human right to life and are allowed to die. Currently, there is no federal criminal statute in place to protect these babies after they are born alive. Congress and state legislatures across the country have responded by putting forth legislation to protect infants who survive abortion. However, leftist politicians have blocked efforts in Congress and in state legislatures to pass the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act, which requires that life-saving medical care be given to babies born alive after failed abortion attempts. We must decide as a country where we stand on the issue of infanticide, to either pursue humane protections for those most vulnerable in our society, or continue to subject innocent human life to the whims of abortionists. For more information, visit frc.org/bornalive.
Welcome back. This is Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here at FRC Action. I am filling in for Tony Perkins on this Tuesday edition. Well, before I get to my final guest, I want to issue a quick reminder to what we've talked about previously. We know that the radical left is showing its true colors, the legislative agenda, the news media, big tech. It's all clear to us. Through advocating for special LGBT rights that will erode religious freedom, to pushing for abortion on demand, even up until and including the day of birth, it is clear our freedoms are at stake and innocent lives are on the line. FRC won't stop fighting to uphold religious liberty and save unborn children, but we need your help. Our fiscal year ends on June 30th, and we must finish this year strong to sustain the momentum we have for pro-faith and pro-life policies here in Washington, D.C. We are challenging our listeners to help us in a $25,000 challenge match, doubling your gift dollar for dollar. So with so much on the line, won't you call 1-800-225-4008? That is 1-800-225-4008. Help FRC remain standing strong as your voice in Washington, D.C. As another reminder, TonyPerkins.com is our podcast address. You can there share information. You can share the podcast. You can find resources related to today's guests, papers, links, and more. Follow Tony on Twitter at T Perkins, or you can follow me if you'd like at Sarah P. Perry. I have occasionally had the interesting thing to say on my Twitter feed. Well, what I'm going to talk about this last segment has me frequently up in arms. It is an issue about which I have been extremely passionate for some time, and as a mother of three children, how can I not be? I have three children, 15, almost 13, and 10. They are students in public school. We don't have an opportunity to send them to private school to prevent the indoctrination that often comes so frequently and so vociferously from the left. And we are in an environment where heretofore we have been very, very fortunate. Open lines of communication with our teachers, an opportunity to review the sex ed curriculum without any particular brouhaha. And even though there are the occasional gay and lesbian student alliance pamphlets or flyers headed out, my children are fighters. But let me tell you, they are fighters only because I myself have had to fight from the outset. Day one in public school, parents and educators need to be aware of what comes in through the funnel from other organizations, because public teachers are beholden to the school boards, who are beholden to the school districts, who are beholden to the state. And so much of this is full of ideology. So today I'm going to talk about the anti-hate, anti-bullying programs in public school, not just the education itself, not just the curricula, but the anti-bullying, anti-hate programs. They sound like a great idea. We understand that mental health crises among teenagers and today's youth are at an all-time high. But are these anti-bullying programs always what they seem? You might be surprised to learn that teachers' unions are pushing a platform to report hate incidents that links directly to the discredited Southern Poverty Law Center. Do you remember the SPLC? The SPLC, the once vaunted organization that broke the financial back of the Klan in the 80s, and the same SPLC whose top management has resigned in the midst of racist and sexist scandals dating back at least 15 years. Yes, that Southern Poverty Law Center. The Southern Poverty Law Center that includes Alliance Defending Freedom, American Family Association, and the Family Research Council, next to neo-Nazis, racist skinheads, and the Klan. That SPLC. Joining me now to pull back the curtain, as it were, is Rebecca Friedrichs, author of Standing Up to Goliath, who is also a former teacher, many years in education, and the president of For Kids and Country. Rebecca, so glad to have you back on Washington Watch.
It is great to be back with you. Thanks for inviting me.
So I'd like to talk about these anti-hate, anti-bullying programs in the public school. We can say, coming from a 30,000-foot perspective, that there's a need for programs like this. Do they have a noble origin?
Well, I think when you hear the words they use to describe them, they sound very noble. But the problem is that our teachers' unions are working with some very divisive groups, and they are working to push an agenda into our schools. And they say they're eradicating hate, but the experience that we're having as teachers, as boots-on-the-ground teachers and parents, is that they are being very hateful to us and hateful to the values that have always allowed us to have very safe classrooms and to educate well. And so we're actually feeling very much under attack. The teaching profession's in crisis right now.
I want to talk a little bit about the SPLC's Teaching Tolerance Project, and I could truly take this entire segment again to talk about the SPLC, from its finances to its leadership to its mission statements to its obviously political partisanship and defamation campaigns against those it disagrees with. But let me go strictly to their educational initiative. That's the Teaching Tolerance Platform. We're going to marry these two issues together, the anti-bullying program and teaching tolerance. They have distributed, as I understand it, more than 50,000 copies of a classroom film, Bullied, as well as an associated teaching kit to educators across the nation. What does the film and the accompanying material communicate to teachers and students?
Well, I've never seen their film, Bullied, so I would love to see that and see what it's actually presenting. But I would like to share with your audience a personal testimony of a teacher who actually has been trying to get answers about this very project. So she is a school board member here in Orange County, California, and also a teacher, many years, over 20 years teacher. And so her name, we call her Priscilla in my book because we're trying to protect her identity, because when you push back on this stuff, you get bullied. So let me just read to you from my book her testimony. Priscilla went to a CTA, California Teachers Association, union conference, youth conference, and she told me, quote, during a CTA equity and human rights conference in 2016, I attended a workshop titled We Must Engage Charter Schools. A CTA legislative advocate, a union lobbyist, was the presenter. In a sincere desire to properly follow her legal responsibilities under the new California Healthy Youth Act, which is being pushed by these organizations, and to more fully understand her CTA's stance, after the presentation, Priscilla detailed this following classroom situation to the CTA lobbyist. Quote, I used to teach high school. I had a transgender student, gay students, and students of faith in my classes. In the context of a class discussion, a Mormon student expressed his personal beliefs about marriage being between a man and a woman. He shared his views respectfully, end quote. She then asked the presenter the following question, quote, as a teacher, do you think I should have handled that situation in order to respect the diversity of all of my students? The CTA lobbyist replied, quote, you should treat that student as though he said, black people should be burned at the stake, end quote.
Oh, so what wow.
Right. So they are claiming that they are teaching tolerance and anti-hate, but it is exactly the opposite. That Mormon student is not safe in the classroom if he can't even share his deeply held beliefs.
So it's free speech and tolerance for me, but not for thee, if you hold the politically incorrect, inconvenient, and unpopular opinion that marriage, biblically recognized, is between a man and a woman.
Right, so, and it goes go ahead.
California itself is particularly bad, and you actually sent me a link to their teaching toolkit. Is California an outlier in this respect, or are we seeing more of this kind of partnership of hard left ideology with other states?
I'm so glad you asked that. California is not an outlier. I'd like to also read to your audience a 2017 adopted business item of the National Education Association. That's the national group that is over all of the teachers' unions across the country. Their adopted business item says, in partnership with Southern Poverty Law Center. And then it lists a bunch of other organizations that NEA is going to track incidences of discrimination, racism, homophobia, transphobia, and they go on, and that they are going to try to eradicate hate through the development of programs. And they go on about unconscious bias training and all of this other stuff. Well, the problem is, as you can see on the toolkit you're discussing that's on the California Teachers Association website, CTA and all of these unions are working together with Southern Poverty Law Center and other very, very powerful organizations. And they are actually pushing for teachers to turn all of our students into social justice warriors. Not, you know, they're not pushing for us to do a great job teaching math, reading, you know, how to write a decent paragraph. They're pushing for social justice warriors. And what kind of social justice? The kind that the far left believes is social justice. Nobody else's idea of social justice.
So if I'm a teacher in the public education system and the National Education Association is sort of the governing body for education, am I required to join a teachers union like the NEA, or do I have other options?
Well, thank God, as of last June 2018, teachers and all public employees are now free to pay unions nothing. However, we are still under their monopoly control. They have monopoly bargaining privileges. So you can't bring in another union if you don't like them. And they've had this monopoly control for almost 50 years, and we were forced to fund them for those 50 years. So they have a lot of power. They have become what they used to fight. They no longer really represent good and loving teachers who want to do what's right for kids. They are pushing a very radical social, sexual, and political agenda into our schools and onto our country. And I hope that teachers listening will realize that Americans love you, teachers. We want good. Mm. We want caring teachers. But your state and national unions, they're not representing you anymore, and you no longer have to pay them, and you can even stand together and decertify them and come together and just have your own local association if that's what you want to do. So this is not about attacking teachers at all. This is about helping to educate teachers that they're being used to fund a very angry agenda that really is bringing damage to kids and our country.
What is the option for parents who, like me, don't have an option to pull their children out of public school and either homeschool or send to private school, either because it's cost prohibitive or there isn't an option in the area? What does a parent of a public school child do about this?
Well, you know, it's really tough right now because here in California, we have thousands of parents standing up against a very radical sexual agenda that is being pushed through the teachers' unions and these same powerful groups, including Planned Parenthood. And we are coming up against a legislature that is controlled by the teachers' unions and these other groups. And we're having a really hard time here making our voices heard. They're pushing things through that we parents and teachers are against. And that are really damaging to our kids. Right now, personally, parents have got to stand up. This is all coming to a state near you. I mean, we're seeing a lot of parents starting to homeschool, just taking their kids out. And I know everyone doesn't have that option, but we have got to flood every single school board meeting. We have to get out and vote for people that refuse to allow this stuff to continue. We just have to stand up like never before, and I think the church is key. A lot of churches have been very afraid. A lot of pastors are afraid to allow someone like myself to come in and educate their teachers on how their money is really being used. We need pastors to stand up and say, hey, it's not political to educate teachers on where their money is going. This is how we protect our kids. So we just all need to stand together.
Who their associations are actually partnering with in the first place. I have always been of a mind that I send my children as lights out into a dark place and that they would stay in public education as long as they had more influence in the system than the system has on them. So if there are parents listening who have children in public school, I encourage you to ask questions, stand strong, and help to educate your teachers who sometimes themselves need to be taught where the bias is coming from. Rebecca, yes. We are so grateful for you and the work that you do. If people want to get in touch with you, how can they do so?
They can find us at forkidsandcountry.org, F-O-R, forkidsandcountry.org.
Rebecca Friedrichs has been my guest today. I will also say the SPLC just this morning argued on their challenge to a property tax law in the state of Mississippi that would remove state funding from charter schools. So it's either take our doctrine or go someplace else as long as you pay for it. This has been Washington Watch. Again, find more information on our website, frc.org, but specifically, go to tonyperkins.com, where we have our podcast site. Follow Tony on Twitter at tperkins, and me, if you'd like, at Sarah P. Perry. We have lots more exciting developments on tap this week. We'll be following the stories from Washington, D.C., here on Washington Watch. We'll talk to you next time.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.